News Talk Breakfast.
In association with AIR. Do anything, anywhere with high-speed 4G mobile data coverage across 96% of the population.
This is News Talk.
In 1988, the state papers have just been released. The 30 years are up. Ralph Regal from the Irish Independent has been going through them and he joins us now on the line. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Kieran.
This is kind of remarkable, the highlights for it. You'd forget how much the Troubles dominated the news agenda in 1988, so we will start there. And let's start with the relationship between Charles Haughey and Margaret Thatcher. My God, it was tetchy, wasn't it?
It was, and I think it's when you look back in 1988 you realise that it was a relationship that was always going to be very difficult. Of course, in 1987, Charles Haughey and Fianna Fáil came to power, and it was a very difficult time coming to power because they were in the middle of very serious economic issues, and there was financial constraints on the government in terms of what they could do. But really, it was Northern Ireland and the relationship with the UK that was dominating everything for the first couple of months, right into 1988. Of course, the Anglo-Irish Agreement had been agreed between Margaret Thatcher and Dr. Garret Fitzgerald, Mr. Haughey's predecessor. And I think she was very concerned about his commitment to the Anglo-Irish Agreement and his commitment to a lot of the key issues of the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And of course, it wasn't helped by the fact that there was horrendous violence in that particular year. I mean, you had the Gibraltar killings, where the SAS shot three members of an active service unit, the IRA. You had the Milltown Cemetery attack, where Michael Stone, the solo loyalist paramilitary, attacked the mourners at the funeral of the Gibraltar Three. And then you had the two corporals who were beaten to death when they accidentally drove into the funeral cortege of one of those killed at the Milltown Cemetery attack. And then to cap it all off, you had, I think it was six soldiers killed at a Lisburn bombing, where the IRA were using Semtex, which they had gotten substantial quantities of arms and munitions and explosives from Libya. The Exxon vessel was seized that year as well. So Margaret Thatcher, her primary focus was improved security cooperation. There were other major issues to do with the extradition. In one extraordinary piece, she talks about the Gardaí, and she effectively accuses them of incompetence.
Yeah, she said they're not a very professional force. Explain this to me then, because this is the case. A lot of people might have forgotten the details of it, or younger listeners won't have heard them. Father Patrick Ryan, who himself was kind of a remarkable character.
Yeah, again, Pierre, I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, when you're going through the state papers and you're reading these, you know, ultra secret and couriered by hand documents that are regarded as so sensitive, they weren't even entrusted to the post. And you're reading the actual exchanges between the two prime ministers. And it was clear that they were both under tremendous pressure. I mean, at one point, Margaret Thatcher is actually saying that Northern Ireland makes her feel berserk. And you have her saying, Charles Haughey's trying to explain a potted history of Ireland and the UK and saying, look, you know, there are high tensions here and people feel very strongly about issues. And she said, how long is that going to last? And he says about 700 years. So you have that level of exchange. But the Father Patrick Ryan thing, in many ways, really brought the relationship probably to its lowest point, on the basis that Father Patrick Ryan was a priest. He was from County Tipperary, and the UK authorities accused him of acting to support the IRA, and he vehemently denied this, but he refused even to be transferred by his order to the UK. But he was detained in Belgium. The UK authorities looked for his extradition. The Belgians rejected it, and they sent him back to Ireland on a military plane. Once he arrived in Ireland, an extradition request arrived from the UK. But of course, in the meantime, there had been extensive coverage of the case in the tabloid newspapers in the UK, most of it virtually hysterical. And it had actually been raised within the House of Parliament as well. And there was a number of very, very controversial comments and exchanges about Father Ryan within Parliament. And once the extradition request arrived in Ireland, our Attorney General, John Murray, looked at the case and came to the conclusion that because of the extent of the prejudicial material in the UK, including comments by senior government ministers, there was no way he could receive a fair trial. So he recommended against extraditing him. So when Ireland refused to extradite him back to the UK, the British authorities went absolutely bananas. And it was very much a sop that the Irish authorities said, well, look, under the 1976 Criminal Jurisdiction Act, we can try him here for you. But that just simply wasn't satisfying Britain. And it came at the end of the year where there had been so many setbacks and controversies and blows to Anglo-Irish relations that at one point, you've Margaret Thatcher more or less pondering out loud about whether the Anglo-Irish Agreement of 85 was even worth it.
Yeah, and extradition, of course, it wasn't just the Patrick Ryan case. Extradition was a real sticking point between both jurisdictions as well around that period. We have to mention as well the Birmingham Six, because, you know, that's a kind of a story, a standalone story, really, that people will recognise and know the details well. And their appeal was heard and rejected in 88. And again, coming back to Thatcher and Haughey, the Birmingham Six appeal was something she stood over. Said, I've read the judgment and everything looks good.
Yeah, absolutely. She wasn't budging. She said, number one, we have separation between politics and the judiciary. I don't get involved in these things. But she said, I have read it. It's the most excellent judgment. It's the most excellent review. And, you know, it is what it is. But it's very interesting when you read Charles Haughey, he really does almost, it's like a personal appeal to Margaret Thatcher to say, look, I need something done on this. Is there anything at all you can do with, you know, the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, the Maguires? He was trying to explain that these were huge issues in Ireland, that people saw these as, you know, injustices and wanted something done about it. And he tried several different ways of appealing to Margaret Thatcher to get her to do something. At one point, he's saying, look, I'm not looking for a pardon. I'm simply looking for clemency. Is there not anything small, even a small gesture will do? But she wasn't budging on the issue.
It'd be easy to kind of get bogged down in all the troubles and all the issues related around the troubles and Anglo-Irish relations. But what else in 1988 stood out in the state papers?
Yeah, it's funny. I suppose the thing that probably most of us remember is hardly mentioned at all, which is Euro 88.
Oh, yeah. Stuttgart.
It put Ireland on the football radar. And, you know, it was the feel-good issue of 1988. Very little reference to it. The chances are we'll probably get a lot of references to things surrounding Euro 88 in next year's state papers. But there were some interesting things. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it was a time of tremendous financial restraint because of the economic difficulties that were facing Ireland. There was a memo issued in 87, once the Haughey government came to power, that effectively all state spending was going to be cut back, and particularly in terms of diplomatic spending. So in other words, state dinners, the number of people allowed to attend state dinners, the amount spent on those state dinners would all have to be restricted. But of course, that didn't really prove to be the case in practice. And one of Charles Haughey's great heroes was François Mitterrand, the French president. Mm. And there was a state visit from François Mitterrand. And it was fascinating to read through some of the private documentation, because they're basically talking about a particular type of wine, which I think cost 10 quid a bottle. But a guy was mentioned, one of the civil servants was saying, look, it costs 10 quid a bottle, but it tastes like it's only worth 5 quid a bottle. And someone else said, look, that's absolutely not going to do for this. Send me a list of whatever other wines that you have that we can put on. And it's interesting that there was a state visit from the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and I think there was 5,000 punts at the time spent on it, whereas the Mitterrand visit was between 15 and 20,000 punts spent on it. And also interesting in that Charles Haughey insisted that the French president had to go to visit him at his house in Abbeville, where there could be a private reception thrown in his honour.
Yeah, and I noticed as well from it that the ballroom was unavailable while he was there, because Eimear Mulhern, Charles Haughey's daughter, was using the ballroom to store her wedding presents at the time.
That's right. And there was also a big debate about what specific present should be given to the François Mitterrand. There was talk about, you know, Waterford crystal lamp, Waterford crystal bowls, but I think in the end what he got was a specially commissioned Louis Le Brocky painting.
Oh, well, not too bad. In a cultural sense as well, I suppose Ireland was very different in 88 compared to 2018. The Last Temptation of Christ, there was uproar when it was passed by the Irish Film Censor.
Yeah, it was one of those things, again, that you look at it and you think, am I still in the same country?
Yeah, I know.
it was, I mean, when you look at it now compared to some of the material that's being released, it was so, I mean, inoffensive. But there were letters on file from individuals writing saying, look, the censor is not doing his job. This film has been condemned by the Catholic Church. It's been condemned by the Pope. It's been condemned by bishops. What on earth are we doing saying that this can be shown here? And if the censor won't do his job, will the government not intervene to do it? So, like, on the cultural sense, you had that. But you also had significant changes happening as well in Ireland. Of course, you had the Independent Radio and Television Commission, which effectively began their work. And, of course, that transformed the cultural landscape in terms of radio, because it paved the way for all of the new and independent radio stations.
RT were nervous at the time of this.
Very much so. And I think, you know, if you look at the state papers going back a couple of years ago, RT's proposition was that they be in charge of all local radio stations. That, fair enough, you want local radio, grand, we'll create it, but they'll all be little mini RTE stations controlled by Montrose. Whereas the IRTC effectively ran this franchise system that people could apply for it, you had to renew your franchises. And in fairness, when you look at radio in Ireland, I mean, I think we have one of the highest radio listenerships in the world at this point. So it was obviously a tremendous success.
And before I let you go then, Ralph, as well, just one other story, because it's easy, I suppose, to laugh a little at things like The Last Temptation of Christ. But in terms of cultural upheaval, the state was engaged in a what turned out to be a hugely interesting court case in the European Court of Human Rights that was settled in October of 1988. And it was David Norris's challenge to Ireland's homosexuality laws.
Of course it was. And that was a big thing as well. Of course, that had rumbled through the Irish courts with various adverse judgments. It was appealed to the European Court. And of course, that judgment, which found that Ireland's laws were in breach of commitments to, you know, European human rights, it really was the critical decision which changed the whole attitude towards homosexuality within Ireland. And of course, you know, to be honest about it, it paved the way for our recent referendum for same-sex marriage. So it was a time where you could see the cultural upheaval starting, you could see the cracks in the edifice of old Ireland and the kind of the new Ireland emerging.
All right, look, on that note, Ralph Regal, Irish Independent Southern Correspondent. Ralph, thanks a million for speaking to us. Always interesting stuff, the state papers, plenty of coverage in today's papers, including from Ralph in the Independent, for people who want to look into it in more detail.